Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Gino Caspari, an expert in the archaeology of the Eurasian steppe. Gino is an award-winning Explorers Club fellow and has worked around the world in places as disparate as Russia, Ecuador, Azerbaijan, Italy, Syria, and more. He's done amazing research in multiple understudied regions, using a combination of remote sensing and satellite imagery, paired with ambitious fieldwork. I think it's fair to say that there are not many archaeologists in the world with a wider range of field experience. We discuss his work excavating Siberian tombs, mapping ancient Scythian monuments, walking the melting ice patches of northern Norway, and more. With all that said, my name is Sebastian Weatherby, and this is The Tell. So, first of all, how would you describe yourself as an archaeologist if you had to give an elevator pitch? And what are your favorite aspects of what you do?
So I guess a lot of people who come into archaeology are sort of attracted to the romantic side of archaeology that's being portrayed through media, narrative film, etc. And I guess even though I, of course, have the academic writing, screen time, administration side as well, and to like a large extent, by the way, I kind of found a way to really work on a number of different and exciting projects that keep me traveling, that allow me to work with different people in different cultural environments. And that, to me, is really the joy of conducting field archaeology, is this challenge between the intellectual side of things, but also the physical part, the leadership, the psychological aspects of actually leading an expedition and a small team. And that is really what has kept me on the subject.
This is one of the things I like most about your work, is there are so many archaeologists working in areas that are easy to access and that are very, very thoroughly researched, fighting over little scraps, pieces of a single site that they can write, you know, their thesis on and things like that. And then meanwhile, there are so many remote and understudied regions that need more researchers. And this is, I think, you've got the key skill set, the leadership ability, the grant writing, the logistical chops to actually put together expeditions to these more remote places. And at least to me, this is exactly what we need so much more of in the discipline.
Yeah, I agree. Look, traditionally, archaeology has been organized along geographical subsets because there was such a heavy focus on material and actually knowing all the material. But there's something to be said about these lines of subjects actually holding us back and focusing the research efforts into ever smaller, more detailed areas. When we look talking about Mediterranean archaeology, which is essentially the archaeology of Greece and Rome.
Yeah.
And so there's these huge gaps in archaeology where there are big questions to be answered. There's a massive playground out there, and you know, it's waiting for people to go there and actually find out. And that's one of the fascinating things, and it's a specific skill set, and you need to be quite ready to step out of your comfort zone again and again. That is one of the issues with academia, that once we have a PhD, we feel like reasonably comfortable in a tiny narrow area that we are the experts, right? And then some people never move beyond that anymore, right? And so for me, it's more about one learning curve overlapping the next. And so I think fairly strong methodologically, and I know a lot about organizing expeditions, but also I have a huge network of specialists that I can bring in for specific tasks. And that is really what archaeology is about these days. It's like good archaeology is holistic archaeology, and you need to look at a topic from various perspectives.
Yeah, it really does take something like a heist team of specialists, like bioarchaeology, geoarchaeology, zooarchaeology, paleobotany, epigraphers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You need to have a whole team of specialists.
Exactly. And at this point, you know, the actual archaeologist is kind of a center node in this network, because when you just have a geneticist talking about something, you just naturally miss a lot of the important cultural aspects, a lot of the anthropological theory. And having someone who brings these data together and has sort of a decent but not expert understanding of all these specialist areas around it, that is extremely important.
But beyond playing that role of the generalist, that central node, how would you describe your own specialties within archaeology? For instance, I think it'd be fair to call you an expert in the cultures of the ancient Eurasian steppe, right?
Yes, so I have worked a lot on the steppe, and I've certainly acquired a bit of an expertise over the past 10 years of fieldwork in the steppe, but I also have this focus on geospatial data analysis and remote sensing, which is really an ideal tool to look at human-environmental interaction. And that is, I think, something where I would locate my specialty the most. And it's also something that allows me to look at different areas, explore different environments, because the questions remain similar and the tools that we use to solve these questions.
Now, before we dive more into the way that you've applied these tools for your work out on the steppe, I was wondering if you could, for a moment, give a bit of a sales pitch for your average history nerd about why they should be more into steppe history and steppe archaeology. I think it's fair to say, especially for the listeners of this podcast, who are going to be mostly Americans, being a history buff means being into the history of the Civil War, World War I and World War II, maybe medieval Europe, maybe the classical world, but the steppe is a bit more of a blank spot on the map. So what drew you to the history and the archaeology of the steppe?
Actually, me not really knowing that much about it was one of the original draws. It was this curiosity that you have these people who are portrayed kind of as wild barbarians coming in and raiding settled people's places. But I always felt like they were treated as peripheral people. And there was just like, oh, and then these guys come in and then they burn down a city, but then like they build it up again, whatever. And then also Central Asia and the steppe as a space has really for the longest time been treated as an area that doesn't really have a sense of place. It's a go-through place between Silk Roads, between Rome and China, and everything in between doesn't matter. And then once you really get into it, you discover an immensely rich culture, history, diversity of peoples, and really interesting questions I can just recommend people to start reading about it, because you'll discover a completely colorful and new world. So we know the Scythians mostly from the Greek sources, namely Herodotus, and they're portrayed as these fierce warrior nomads that do have no cities, but really good at horseback archery, and that can essentially not be defeated because they ride very fast, extremely skillful riders and archers. Sometimes a bit, maybe, mythologized ethnography that is going on. There's a lot of talk about quite cruel practices like scalping and using people's hairs, napkins, and things that like they didn't sound like the friendliest people. Of course, in reality, not everything was warfare on the steppe, and people had fairly nice family lives as well. that's how the Greek historian depicts them. And so
I hadn't really thought before about how much that means steppe history is portrayed in written records pretty much only through the lens of a military perspective.
That is kind of natural, because all the sources that we have are people who can actually write, who are from the outside. And for the early Iron Age in particular, the steppe is just prehistoric. And so whatever other people write about them is when they come in contact, and that is often in the context of warfare.
Yeah. Over the years, I've only started to appreciate more and more how, even beyond warfare, in terms of technology and the spread of language groups and gene flow and trade across Eurasia, how important the steppe is to understanding a good portion of world history altogether.
Yeah, the thing is, if you're looking at gene flow, you're looking at the transfer of languages, you're looking at innovations from horses to chariots to bronze casting and other things, it's really difficult to completely ignore this step.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely worth at least reading a little bit about it.
And where did you get your own start leading fieldwork? I think I've read that some of your early expeditions were to Western China. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's where I did my PhD and where I naturally established the first field projects that I actually led myself. I did excavations and surveys. Before that, I worked in Turkey, Italy, in Syria, only for one season, unfortunately, right into the civil war. So I've had gathered some experience, and then northwestern China, Xinjiang, really was the first time that I set everything up from scratch and selected my own team members, organized the entire logistics, and designed the research questions.
And were you already applying a geospatial focus to your research at that point?
Yes, very much so. Xinjiang is a very tricky area to get into. At the time when I started my PhD, I sort of naively thought, well, look, all the archaeological distribution maps sort of stop at the Russian border, and there's really nothing in Xinjiang. So I'm just going to go and find out, because it can't be possible that there's just nothing there, right? Only after a while I found out why there was no data points in the area, because it was really, really hard to get permits and work with people there. Because
what was that process like? I mean, I can't imagine it's easy to get a permit from the Chinese government.
What was the process like? The thing is, I was lucky because I spent a lot of time traveling in China, and I spoke the language, which gave me really good access and an in with the local people. And that was, in the end, I think, pure coincidence that I met the right people that were open for conducting some research, working together, and then just generally interested in working with a young guy like me. If you want to set this up as an institution and you want to go through Beijing and go sort of the official route, you can spend years in nice dinners and meetings and talking about what might be eventually maybe possible. But right, essentially, you'll never get anything done. And that is was sort of a lucky case for me, because that allowed me to finally actually also gather some data on the ground. But a lot of what I did was through satellite imagery.
And what kind of sites were you actually looking for? Did you have a particular period and that you were focused on, or a particular site type or anything like that?
So I was really looking at the late prehistory, Bronze Age, early Bronze Age to kind of Turkic period. That's the period in the steppe where we have all kinds of different stone monuments that you can very well see. There's not a lot of soil accumulation on the steppe. So essentially what you have is just an early Bronze Age monument next to a medieval one. And people were aware of it more or less the entire time. Not that it's early Bronze Age, but that something was there.
Uh-huh.
And so I was interested in these large cross-chronological questions.
How big was your study area in Xinjiang? And how much of your time was spent before you actually got into the field? Like, I don't know, what, scanning satellite images segment by segment? Hours and hours and hours spent in the lab just kind of combing through images? What was the process like? And yeah, how big of an area?
So that's how it started. I spent weeks and months poring over high-resolution satellite imagery that I'd finally gotten through a grant from the European Space Agency. I ended up surveying, I think, around 300 square kilometers.
Wow.
So a sizable area that certainly in terms of a survey methodology and also number of sites detected was not something that had been done before in Xinjiang.
And what was the experience actually like on the ground of doing the fieldwork in Xinjiang once you were actually there? What are the sites like in person? What does the landscape look like? Set the scene, if you would.
Xinjiang is essentially split in two by the Tian Shan Mountain. The south is very arid, where you have the Taklamakan Desert. It's generally termed the Silk Roads going through there. And then the north is mountainous and more steppe area. Then you have a minority, the Uyghurs, who have lived there since a very long time. And they are a Turkic minority. They speak a Turkic language. They look very different from average Han Chinese person. They speak a different language. They are Muslims. So it is a very different feel than anywhere else in China.
And what was the on-the-ground portion of this? Were you ground-truthing, essentially, the work you've done with satellite data?
Yeah, so I went through the satellite imagery and marked everything that looked like it would be a site. And then we drove around and then did sort of standardized surveys, walking lines, and mapping out everything by GPS. It's a fun story because essentially this is one of the most heavily surveilled areas in China because, listeners might have heard about the Uyghur cultural genocide and the oppression that is going on in that particular region, which is for me ultimately also the reason why I stopped working there, because I had friends who ended up in those camps, and at some point it became impossible to work there because purely a foreigner contacting a local person could lead to them ending up somewhere in a jail. And of course, this is not something that you can ethically maintain. Anyway, so it was like heavily militarized and lots of police around, general checks, so you cannot stay in any hotel as a foreigner, but you have to actually send your passport to the police station. They need to know where you are at every point in time. And I was avoiding that a little bit through hitchhiking and sleeping in a tent and having a bivouac somewhere, or staying with Kazakh and Uyghur friends in a yurt somewhere. And then you would pop up after 2 weeks of field work again. And the police was like, where were you? You were not exactly being tracked right now. I was like, we kind of want to know where you are.
Yeah. And then I'd imagine perhaps in part because of how difficult it was to work in Xinjiang, your focus then shifted to Tuva, right?
Exactly. So I spent a bit of time in St. Petersburg, made the first contact with my Russian colleagues. And given that when you look at the map, Xinjiang is not all too far away from southern Siberia, Altai, northern Mongolia. I knew the material culture there already fairly well. I understood what I was dealing with. Plus, this area of Tuva is really famous in Eurasian archaeology because there's some of the largest royal burial mounds out there. And so, of course, working there for young archaeology at the time, like me, it was just, that was an amazing opportunity. What still was, at the time, was fairly poorly understood is this Bronze Age-Iron Age transition where we have, for the first time, the Scythian culture emerging where you have animal style and horses and weapons.
Right, and those three things being commonly referred to as the Scythian triad, right? Weapons, horse bridles, and art, animal art?
Yes, those are the three things, yes. And so this transition really seems to happen in that area because we have some of the earliest Scythian monuments there. And but there's essentially one that was Arjan I. This is a big tomb about 110 meters in diameter.
Whoa.
With a lot of horses sacrificed and a really unique wooden architectural structure underneath the stone pile. And I thought, well, if there's one of these things there, there must be more. It's very rare that we have just these absolutely unique monuments, even though they've been treated like that in the literature. And so using satellite imagery, we went through a lot of the burial mounds in the region, and we actually found one that looked to have underneath this cover of rocks a similar radial structure of wood. And so I set up a small expedition with the goal of going there, digging down in one of these spokes and finding wood, dating it, and seeing whether this would really date into the time frame between Bronze Age and Iron Age. So it seems to be quite a short-lived but extremely important burial tradition for the highest elite on the steppes.
Is this the point where you really started to develop an interest in mortuary archaeology, or had that already kind of emerged in your work in Xinjiang? Like, I imagine there also a lot of the sites you were finding were burial mounds.
Very much so. The thing is, steppe archaeology has traditionally been mortuary archaeology. That's kind of where the idea of nomadism comes from, because people weren't able to find settlements. So they're like, oh, people must have been running around all the time, which is not exactly the case. We do understand that a little bit better. It's just that the seasonal settlement sites are very, very difficult to find, and they're kind of ephemeral structures. And so it's much easier, and of course traditional archaeologists in the 19th, early 20th century, well, there's nice stuff in there, so of course we're going to excavate the graves. Yeah, because, I mean, archaeology was essentially art history, and so you need something to work with.
Right, right.
That's not quite how we do things anymore. Mortuary archaeology, of course, still is very important because it gives us skeletons, for example, where then we get insights into genetics, into diet, and so on and so forth. But we now have a better grasp as well about sort of human environmental interaction, how they're using seasonal transhumans, how we have small-scale mobility. We have a better grasp of the economies on the steppe, which can be very diverse, actually, depending on where exactly you are.
Going forward, what kind of questions do you most want to answer about steppe archaeology?
So something that I have been interested in for a while is really the questions of elites on the steppe.
Uh-huh.
And really these broad cultural dynamics that we see in the first millennium BC associated with kind of quote-unquote Scythian culture. That, in my opinion, has been not really tackled in the right way in traditional research. It's been either looked at as, you know, like one large ethnicity or steppe empires. And
yeah, I think in the way that a lot of people think about the Scythians, it's maybe biased by that Greek or that European perspective where they expected to be sort of focused on the Western steppe alone, but it really stretches like all the way across the Eurasian steppe, and it's hard to imagine that as a unified single empire.
It does, like in some ways, go all the way to Mongolia, but the problem is that these people are not one people. They don't perceive themselves as being one entity. They have not been politically unified at any given point in time, as we see it later on the steppe, and that's a problem that you often see with historians that take things that they see in later periods and project that back in time.
Yeah.
It's not really the case. Well, I think the Scythian phenomenon really is elite tastes that spread very quickly across the steppe. But underlying these elites, we have local people with highly specialized economies that are really well adapted to the respective niches. And I think that is something that really needs to be brought out through a number of larger case studies. And I think that be something that I'm very interested in working in the future.
So how do we then perceive the sudden emergence of this new set of elite tastes? Is it just a shift in artistic traditions and tastes, or is it also a shift in, or I should say, an increase in elite power and prestige across the region?
It is both. It's really the first time that we also see very steep hierarchies on the steppe. So, for example, the burial mound I've been excavating in Tuva It has like 120, under 30 meters in diameter. It's thousands of tons of rocks. This is not something that a family, even an extended family, just builds for, you know, an elder or something like that. So there is significant resources that go into this. And, you know, depending on the time frame during which they built this monument, at least hundreds, if not thousands of people, when we're looking at not just the immediate builders, but sort of the logistical support and bringing stones and huge trees, actually, to build the wood structure underneath to this site and setting everything up.
It's interesting. It's interesting to think about how these sorts of monumental mortuary sites shape a sense of place on the steppe. While one might imagine highly mobile steppe peoples to treat the land in a very fluid sort of way, do mortuary practices like these suggest some degree of territoriality? And is it a new degree of territoriality?
It's not exactly new. People have been talking about burial mounds in that way as kind of territorial markets, and they clearly are on essentially flat landscape like the steppe. This is a visual marker, and even Herodotus talks about it when different groups are fighting that they sometimes loot the burials of the ancestors of another tribe as a kind of psychological warfare. And so the idea is clearly around, and they function as that. The steppe is not exactly very fluid in terms of territory, because people live off the land, and they live based on domestic animals.
Right.
And these animals need to eat. So there is a very clear incentive there to reserve the best pastures for you and your relatives, and then of course people die there, and you also erect burial mounds and markers. But really, I think what is the reason to protect places is resources. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit more about the kinds of artifacts and objects that were coming out of these tombs in Tuva that you studied?
Yeah, so what we have is a lot of horse gear. We have kind of the bronze bridles and generally things that you use for sophisticated horse riding. And then we have effectively architecture, which is interesting because people normally don't think about burial mounds as exactly being architecture, either piles of earth or piles of rocks.
Yeah.
And in our case, we have really complex wood construction with large logs that are sometimes up to 250, 300 years old. So gorgeous source for dendrochronology. And we've, of course, been taking samples of every individual tree trunk, which is a lot of work because the wood that comes out is like you'd be felling a fresh tree. Is really hard. It's really hard. There's nothing like the mushy, falling apart kind of stuff that you get in some other areas. No, it's, yeah. You need a proper chainsaw, ideally, to get through it.
Wow, geez.
So that's something. And then recently we have found a lot of horse sacrifices and what potentially are also human sacrifices. And we have a whole number of later burial structures that are situated around this main tomb. So in the south, we have now more than 100 individuals from the early centuries AD. So there we also see widespread violence. We see skeletal trauma. We have actual evidence for scalping, little fine lines along the skull that really show people were collecting hair. And so there's a lot of interesting and also unexpected things that come out when you start an excavation. So I never really imagined to work on this site and publish a lot of papers on things that are, you know, early centuries BC to AD, that I'm really, well, at this point, I'm starting to become a specialist on this type of stuff, but I had to do a lot of reading to even be able to work with this. And it's the beauty of having these big excavation projects, because there's always something unexpected that comes up and it forces you to learn something new.
What time periods have come out of the work at these sites in Tuva? Is it primarily Scythian, or are other periods represented as well?
So we have about a runtime of 2,500 years of this particular site.
Quite a time span.
Yes. So it starts with Bronze Age ceramics. And then, of course, the main part, the main structure is early Iron Age Scythian. But then we have some Xiongnu ceramics. Then a large portion are these burials from the early centuries AD. And then we also have Turkic burials with horses and stirrups and other things. So it's really quite a broad assemblage of materials you have to deal with.
And on a more sour note, I imagine with the war in Ukraine and the sanctions and all of the geopolitical tensions that it's become impossible to work in Russia in recent years. What has that been like?
It's really, really difficult. And it has, in fact, destroyed a lot of the international relations between researchers in the archaeological field. I think it will take years to build this up again. So at the moment, it is not really possible to properly work in Russia. Just already out of the fact that like bringing or sending money there is kind of sanctions avoidance. And you don't want to get into that territory. So it is not just an ethical problem, but it is also a legal risk for the individual researchers. That being said, of course, there's a diversity of opinion among archaeologists who tend to be often, like at least the younger colleagues, kind of left-leaning, being liberal, and are not exactly hardcore nationalists who support invading foreign countries, right? So there's also a lot of risk on their side. And that's something we have to be mindful of. It's very annoying if you've worked on a project like this for years and you have to stop because of things that are effectively beyond your control.
And if the geopolitical situation were to shift, is there more work to be done there at the site? Do you want to go back and continue working?
Yes, there's more to be done. So there's more left to do. We understand the architecture now fairly well. We have a very good grasp on the periphery, although we've recently found out that if you take a thermal sensor and a drone and you fly over the area, you actually find additional burials that we missed so far. And it's interesting because the tomb is situated in a swamp with very dense vegetation, but the rocks heat up a little more over daytime, and so you have no chance of seeing that in optical, even very high resolution imagery. No chance. LiDAR doesn't work either, but with the heat signature of the rocks just at dusk or dawn, we have a chance to see that there's additional burials hidden in the swamp.
Although I guess it's rather a shame that there won't be a chance anytime soon to go and ground truth it. Given the current situation in Russia, what are you doing lately? Are you kind of turning your sights elsewhere?
Over COVID, I've started working in Arctic Norway up towards Hammerfest, and we were looking at glacial archaeology, checking out ice patches. There's this curious thing that the reindeer in summer, they go up on the ice to seek refuge from mosquitoes and flies, and that's where they were hunted.
Oh, yeah. In alpine regions of Alaska, we actually have a lot of the same kinds of sites where, yeah, people were doing the exact same thing. Caribou were taking shelter from flies and ice patches, and they were convenient killing grounds for people.
Yeah, and so, of course, in the ice, then once in a while, somebody misses a shot, and then you have arrows there with the fletching still attached, and so it's really interesting archaeology, although like mostly hunting related, but it's cool to have such well-preserved artifacts from very early times.
And did I also see on social media that you were in Kazakhstan recently too?
Yeah, so Kazakhstan. I've recently been in Kazakhstan. That was not exactly my project. I was just visiting a colleague there who's excavating a medieval city.
Oh, wow. Big site.
Yeah, I'd say like 17, maybe 20 meters of cultural strata. Really more like a tell structure of mud brick architecture. And it's out in the desert now. It used to be situated right next to a river. During Soviet times, they diverted the river, built a lot of canals, and by now the area is dust dry and interesting place to work on, though.
Well, aside from projects like that, where it's not really, you know, one that you're running, do you have any projects that you're leading yourself lately that you've kind of turned to since Russia's closed off?
Yeah, so I have one project in Azerbaijan that I cannot really talk about yet. But in due time, things will come out. And then I have a whole range of side projects. For example, we're working on automatic detection of pit houses in Arctic Norway. We are working on a study on Pazaric tattoos at the moment because...
Oh, wow.
For the first time with high-resolution infrared photography, we now have really detailed images and we can understand what the actual techniques were for making these tattoos that you can't from the older publications where you just have black and white drawings.
Wait, now where were these? You called them Pazaric?
Yeah, so in the Altai Mountains, so kind of late Scythian type culture, the Pazaric culture, they built burial mounds fairly high up in the mountains. And through stroke of luck, some of them were preserved in permafrost, including felt items and carpets and wood carvings and as well human mummies. And since the skin is so well preserved, some of them had visible tattoos on them. And there's a number of them that had kind of blackened, oxidized skin where you can see tattoos.
Wow.
And through infrared photography, we're now able to actually find these tattoos again and make them visible again, which, of course, provides new data. And in conjunction with experimental archaeology, we're now able to understand a lot more about these tattooing practices.
Well, I hope you get a chance to revisit your work in Tuva, but it doesn't really sound like you're actually struggling all that much to find cool stuff to do. But with that said, Gino, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Fun conversation. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of The Tell. Until next time.